Please explain emptiness phenomenon again. Okay, so emptiness, and this is one of those fundamental Buddhist words that you hear a lot, and it has different meanings in different traditions. But in the Pali tradition, emptiness means only one thing. It means emptiness of any substantial core inside human beings, or inside any being for that matter, not just humans, but any being that we observe in this, or can observe in this world, are empty of a core inside. Now the core inside is like something, some essential essence inside of you. You might call it a soul, you might call it a self, you might call it whatever, but some entity inside of you which is always there, which you can identify, this is the real me, this is who I actually am. I may have all these impermanent aspects to me. I know the body is impermanent. I know many of my feelings are impermanent. I know that many of my perceptions are impermanent. My thinking is certainly impermanent. But still, there's this feeling inside of you that there's something in there which is the real you. Now the Buddha said that there is no such real you inside of you. It is just an illusion. It looks like it's there. It feels like it's there. But when you analyze things properly, when you do profound meditation and vipassana practice, you find out that in fact there is nothing there which is the real you. It's all just changing phenomena all the time. That is the meaning of emptiness. No self, nothing that belongs to the self. In other words, once you realize that there is no self inside, then also all these belongings, all these things that the self tries to appropriate, that is one of the functions of a self, to have things and to own stuff, all that becomes irrelevant. And that is one reason why one of the characteristics of an arahant, somebody who is fully awakened, is that they cannot store things up like a householder would store things up in a house. And that's why, as an arahant, you are no longer a householder, but you become a monastic straight away. You cannot live the household life as an arahant, because you can't store things up anymore. Because there is no sense of ownership anymore. Things are just the things of the world. Does that make sense? That is about emptiness. Okay, and this is a kind of a question that is an important question. Since normally you can't remember your past lives, how do you know it's actually you in the next life, not a different version of you? In other words, how do you know it's not just somebody else? So you can just say, it's not me, so I don't really need to worry about rebirth. What you can do, and this is of course what the Buddha was saying, he said that when you do remember your past lives, you do actually, it does look like it was you who was there in that past life. It doesn't look like it was somebody else. It feels like it was you. And it is just the same as in this life, the person you are today is a very different person from who you were 10, 20, 30 years ago. Your thinking has changed, your perception has changed, the way you look at the world has changed. Your body certainly has changed. All of these things have changed. Is it still you? Is it a different person? And the answer, it's both. It's both different and the same. There is continuity and there is change. And this is what karma is all about. Change and continuity coming together. And it's exactly the same thing across lives. You may have a new body, but the mind, there's a continuity of the mind there going across from one life to another life. So just as in this life, you feel that there is a continuity inside of you as to who you are, so in exactly the same way, there is a sense that there is a continuity in you from life to life. When you remember a past life, what you will remember is that that was you there in the past life. You will recognize that person as you. And that is why it is a problem. Because you are essentially going on and on and on. The feeling is, the perception is, that you are going on and on, just suffering, going around endlessly, pointlessly, again and again and again. So in a sense, it is you. I mean, let me take an example. If you knew that an act you were doing today would cause incredible suffering for you tomorrow, would you do that act? If you knew that if you, for example, you went to Saudi Arabia, one of these Muslim countries, and you stole a loaf of bread, they would chop off your hand for doing that, would you steal that loaf of bread if you had enough money and you were perfectly okay in other ways? You probably wouldn't, because you don't want to inflict suffering on yourself in the future. Why on earth would you do that? And it's exactly the same with rebirth. Why would you want to inflict suffering on yourself in a future life? Because it is really just the same as in this life. There is continuity from life to life as there is continuity in this life. Does that make sense? Okay. It is true that death is real and we all have to face it someday. Yet how can contemplation of death all the time help to resolve the issues of the living? Okay. Well, the point is, and the point is that when you contemplate death, and this was a point of the sutta before, in a lot of the time in our life, we walk around like, deluded, intoxicated. We're full of desires, or maybe sometimes upset and angry about this, or clouded by confusion. This is very common. I mean, lots of people in the world are like this all the time. And it happens to all of us every now and again. So the point about contemplating death is that it puts things in perspective. If you know that you're going to die, it tells you that, wait a minute, I'm actually going to die. This is not going to last forever. Why should I run around like some, in a stupid fashion, building up lots of wealth, being angry with all these people, just being dull and confused, not spending my life wisely, when I know that I'm going to die and that I will have possibly to face the consequences of all those bad actions after I die? Death has this powerful effect on you to clarify your mind, to make priorities very clear, what is really important in life and what is not important in life. Once you know you're going to die, as I said, why desire? Why have so much desire? Why have so much anger? Those things get put aside in the face of death. They are not so important anymore. And in this way, the contemplation of death helps you with clarity. It helps you in your spiritual practice. It makes your meditation more powerful because the hindrances are reduced when you think in this way. If you could die tomorrow, how easy is it to get angry with the people around you if you knew that you were going to die tomorrow morning, for example? You wouldn't get angry so easily. You would be much more at ease and much more relaxed. You would let go because you know that this world has nothing to do with you anymore. This world doesn't matter. You only get angry because you think that you have to control things. You think that you have to change other people's way of behavior. They shouldn't act this way. You get upset. But when you are going to let go of this whole world anyway, why get upset and angry about the things around you? Why desire things that you can't take with you into the future life? It gives clarity. It gives a sense of perspective. And that is why the contemplation of death is so powerful. And it helps you ultimately in your meditation practice. It is, in fact, contemplation of death is a kind of vipassana practice. It's vipassana because it is about understanding impermanence of things, understanding a non-self because you can't really control this, and understanding suffering because death is a lot about suffering, about having to let go of this world, and of course just the plain physical suffering of the body. Okay, happy, yeah. Please come back to me if you like on some of these questions. Five aggregates, Could you please compare and contrast the second, third, fourth, and fifth components of the five aggregates? They appear similar in nature. Also, please give the Pali names of the five aggregates. Thank you. With metta. Okay, it is a great retreat. Please have another one. Okay, thanks. That's very, very nice to hear. Yeah. So we shall see about another one. I'm sure if it is successful, we can have another one in the future. So the five aggregates. Okay, first I'll do the last part here. First of all, about the five, the names in Pali. The names in Pali are rupa. Rupa is the form aggregate, the physical part of the body. And then you have vedana. Vedana is often translated as feeling. It can also be translated as sensation. And vedana refers to the experience that anything is, whether it's pleasurable, whether it's painful, or whether it's neutral in between. That's what vedana means. It doesn't mean like feeling in an emotional sense. It just means whether something is painful, pleasurable, or neutral. And the third one is sannya in Pali, perception. Perception is how we're able to perceive the world. The fact that we are able to distinguish, for example, between green and blue and red colors, we do that through perception. It is this mental faculty of perception that can make these distinctions. And everything, all distinctions we make are made through this faculty of perception. The fourth one is called sankhara in Pali. And sankhara literally means something like putting together, creating, making something up. And the appropriate understanding of it in the context of the five aggregates is to understand sankhara as the will, the volition, the doer inside of you. That is what sankhara actually is in the five aggregates. And the reason for that is because the doer, the will, is what puts together human beings. It is through the will that we create karma. It is through the will that we, in a sense, produce our future existences. So it creates. Sankhara means like put together, create. So these are the creations of the future that we do using the will. Now sometimes you will hear that sankhara is very broad, that it includes all kinds of mental components like thinking and attention and all these kind of things. And that largely comes from the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma is a later work of the Pali canon. It is not considered the word of the Buddha by scholars. And I too would say that this is not the word of the Buddha. When you read the Abhidhamma, you realize it's a completely different type of literature from the suttas. It doesn't make any sense that the Buddha should have taught this as well. Not only that, it is based on the suttas. It is a further development. And for that reason, again, it is not really the word of the Buddha. So if we stick to the suttas, sankhara means basically just will or volition, the doer aspect inside of us. Now, the fifth khanda is consciousness. And this is the knowing aspect of a person. This is your ability to know things. Consciousness is that which knows. And it is quite right. It says here, compare and contrast these things. That gives you a bit of contrast straight away by just defining these things. But it is true that they do also overlap a lot. For example, most of these factors are always going to be there in your mind. When you have any sort of experience, the knowing part, the consciousness, is always going to be there. You cannot have any experience without consciousness. The feeling aspect is always going to be there. There has to be some tone to that experience, either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, neither one or the other. There has to be perception, because it is through perception that you recognize the experience, that you know what it is. So all of those things have to be there. Volition, there probably also has to be volition in all experiences. In certain experiences, the volition might be frozen. It might just be the same volition all the time without any change. But normally it is said that there's also volition present in all these experiences. So the main reason why the Buddha talks about the five khandhas is not so much that he is analyzing a human being and telling us these are the parts of a human being. That is not the main purpose. The main purpose of the five khandhas is to provide an analysis for where we should look for insights. The Buddha is saying that these places are the places where we tend to find or to look or to have a sense of self. It's usually within these five khandhas. And because of that, in fact, I would say it's always within these five khandhas. So because of that, they are like categories that we use for insight meditation so that we can uncover that in fact there is no self inside of there. And when we go through the five khandhas systematically through insight, you don't even have to go through all of them. If you can see that there's no self in consciousness, then all the others usually follow along. Or in feeling, again, all the others usually follow along because they are so intimately connected with each other. But these are like the bases for insight, and that's why the Buddha points them out in this way. Okay, are you happy with that? Sorry, Ananda. I think you, in a certain way, you can probably say that, but I think, you know, the point is that consciousness is, in a sense, always there. It's always present in all kind of situations. But what you can say is that you want to purify that consciousness. You want to purify it so that it becomes more clear and more understanding and has the ability to actually penetrate reality. And in that sense, you could argue that the consciousness is being maybe held down by the body, it's being held down by the will, because these things tend to cloud our ability to see things clearly. The less the body the more the body gets out of the way, the less willing we do, the more peaceful the mind becomes, the more our ability to see clearly, comes to be. So that is one way of looking at it, I think. You can say that consciousness is held down by all of these things. But it is not held down in the sense that we are looking for a consciousness which is free of all these things. Because there is no such consciousness which is free of the other khandhas. The other khandhas will always have to be there. Consciousness is always together with these other things. And ultimately, we have to let go of consciousness as well. Consciousness is another factor of suffering, as I was mentioning this morning here. So it is not, we're not trying to find some kind of refined consciousness which is beautiful. We're just trying to refine the consciousness to the point where we can see that everything is dukkha, everything is suffering, everything needs to be let go of. So that is how I would answer that that question. Yes. Yeah. I think that's a good point, and I think that you, the very fact that you are able to distinguish between pain and pleasure means that perception has to be there as well, and you cannot have feeling without perception. I think that's very true. In fact, the Buddha does say in one of the suttas that consciousness, perception, and feeling always go together. There's no such thing as separating these three things. They always have to be there in any kind of consciousness, any kind of experience. Yes. Yes. It is, again, it is just like in this life. So what you have to do is you have to think about what is happening in this life right now. What is happening in your mind? If you look at your mind now and you compare to what it was like yesterday or maybe 5 years ago or 10 years ago, you see that your mind is changing all the time. But even though your mind is changing all the time, there's also a sense of continuity there. The sense that you are continuing across time. So there is change and there is continuity. Change and continuity. And that is the stream of consciousness. That's why it's called the stream and not just consciousness, because it is ever fluctuating, always changing. And yet, despite the fact that it's always changing, the continuity is also there. So it's both. And it's exactly the same thing that happens across from one life to the next one. It is continuity, yet change. Yes. Yeah, probably. I think that I don't think it is possible to be completely unconscious in the sense that you can revive again afterwards. There's probably always some kind of consciousness connected with that that body if it's still living. Like sleeping, yeah, or even if you go into like a deep coma or something, yeah, it is very likely that there is some consciousness still connected to that body, otherwise it wouldn't actually live. But sometimes you are so removed from your senses or removed from all these other things that you may not be able to feel anything or perceive anything despite that. It gets very tricky. I'm not sure. You can ask Ajahn Brahm about that question. Okay. Well, there you are. Yeah. Okay. It's very... Are you happy? Did you want to come back on that question there, at the back there? Sure. Yeah. It's exactly the same thing. Yeah. The only thing which dies when you die is the body. The mind continues just like in this life. Right? So the mind is still there. The body falls away, the body dies, and the mind continues. Just like the four aggregates in this life, in the same way those four aggregates, the four mental aggregates, continue when you pass away. So suddenly you will see, oh, my body is down there. That's my body. What happened? You know, it's like an out-of-body experience. And your body... has fallen away, but you still have a sense of being there. You are still there, but now you're seeing your body. So you're just continuing on, but now you are a mental, your mental self rather than your physical self. Okay, think about it and see if you can make any sense of it. I'll move on to the next question. There are so many questions here. So, can people be? Oh, can people be reminded that this is a silent retreat? Thank you. It is very distracting. Okay. Yeah, please be compassionate to the people around you. If you can be silent, that's great. What I like to say always is think about when you are on a retreat like this, think about it that it is like a gift to other people when you are silent. You are helping other people with their practice. There might be some people here who are very good meditators. Who might get disturbed, and maybe perhaps you can even stop them from getting into deep meditation by being too noisy at the wrong time. So think about it as a gift to other people. Then it doesn't feel so oppressive to be quiet. Don't oppress yourself, because that's also unfortunate. Don't feel like you are, you know, you are forced to be quiet against your will. But look at it as a gift to the other people around you and see if that works. Okay. To understand craving for extermination is leading to rebirth, please explain us how a stream winner sees stopping rebirth. Please compare the view of a normal person towards this issue with the view of the stream winner. Okay, so the stream winner, the thing that the stream winner has seen is that there is nothing worth saving in the five khandhas. There's nothing in here. There's nothing in this person that has any value. That's what the stream winner sees. Now, most people we feel that there's something valuable inside of us. There is a me, there is an I in here. You may not be able to pin it down, sometimes just like a vague notion, but there's a sense that there's something valuable inside of us worth preserving. Now that is what the stream winner has seen. There is nothing of value in there. In fact, not only is it not of value, it's plain suffering. It's dukkha. It is worth getting rid of. That is what the stream winner sees. And because of that, he sees that as nothing worth keeping in there, and he knows the path for the ceasing of all these things, that's part and parcel of the understanding the same thing. Then he just walks on that path where all of this suffering just ceases and comes to an end. That is the view and the practice of a stream winner here. He sees there's nothing to hold on to, and because there's nothing to hold on to, he walks the path that leads to the ending of all that suffering. Just like you, if you are ill, you will take the medicine that leads to the end of that illness in your life. In the same way, the stream winner takes the medicine of the Eightfold Path, which leads to the ending of suffering in this life. And that is why the normal person has the sense of a self. Because of that, the normal person thinks that there is something to be looked after inside. Or, if the normal person gets so fed up with life that he thinks that there is nothing worth to look after inside anymore, then the normal person wants to exterminate and destroy that self which they feel they have. And that is the difference. The difference is that even though a normal person doesn't want to exist anymore, their type of non-existence is very different from the stream enterer, because they want to destroy what they see as themselves. They cannot avoid that because they have a sense of being, and because that sense of being, they want to destroy that. Now, that is almost like acquiring a state in the future. It's craving for a state in the future, the state of extermination. It's a bit like craving for rebirth. And because of that craving for something in the future, moving towards something, then, in fact, that craving actually drives them into a new rebirth instead, rather than coming to an end of these things. Does that make sense? Okay. Good. I'll do a few more questions, maybe not too many, because it's getting late already, and probably get back to some more of these questions tomorrow. Ajahn, doing metta on oneself, would it be perceived as a form of craving? The self element is present, and the wish to be well and happy, strong health, etc. Please comment. I think yes, and I think a lot, there is. You have to remember that on the Buddhist path, there is going to be desire. And this is actually something which comes later on in the sutta, the Chanki Sutta that I'm going to continue tomorrow, that there is an element of desire on the Buddhist path. You have to desire to want to do things. You have to desire to do the right thing. And yes, because we want to be happy, there is perhaps an element of craving when we do metta to ourselves, because we want to be happy towards ourselves. But you could argue it's the same thing if you do metta to others. Because why do you do metta towards other people? It is for many reasons. One thing, of course, is because it is nice to other people. But the most important reason why you do metta to others is because you are developing the path yourself by doing that. In other words, it comes back to your own happiness again, even when you do it towards others. So these things are not two separate issues. It's not either me or others. It is always both. And in a sense, you can see the metta towards yourself is also a metta towards others. Because if you have a good feeling about yourself, if you are able to see the good qualities in yourself rather than focusing on the two bad bricks in the wall, then if you feel good about yourself, you will tend to also be kind towards others. These things always go together. They're not separate issues. So don't be too concerned about there being some aspect of craving in there. It is bound to be some aspect of craving. Of course, the less craving there is, and the more pure that metta is a pure kind of radiation towards others and yourself without any distinction either between yourself or other people. Everybody is just like one. That is the ideal kind of metta, where there is no distinction anymore. And then it is pure metta. But that metta, that pure metta is also towards yourself, just like others. It's just that there's no distinction anymore. So just don't, sometimes we tend to be too idealistic at the early stages of the path. We think, oh, I shouldn't be attached, I shouldn't crave, because these are not what Buddhists are supposed to do. But don't worry about that. Don't think that you should this or you should that. You are the way you are. You can't do that much about it. You can't wish these things away by shoulding this or oughting that. The way that you do something about these things is by practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. By practicing that path, gradually you will find that the craving disappears, the attachments become less, and gradually you're moving in the right direction. And just by being kind and compassionate to people around you, by being generous and good, you are reducing your sense of self. You're reducing that sense of being, you know, looking out for yourself all the time. That is also going in the right direction. Yes. I think that the point is that you know, very often we start off with like directing metta towards this person or that person, or this group or that group, or towards ourselves. But the kind of metta that actually gives rise to jhana is not a metta that is focused on anybody in particular. It is a universal kind of metta. And if you read that in the suttas, the Buddha always says that this goes to everywhere, to all, including oneself, is the word that is actually used in the suttas. So you're not actually directly directing against yourself, but you are included as well in that whole metta to everybody. So because of that, it's a non-pointed metta. It is all-inclusive. And I think that is the important part. And that is where that metta can take you into jhana when you get to that point. Yeah, that is how I understand those suttas anyway. Yeah. Okay. Who is the end maker? In text 7, verse 360, it talks about the end maker. Is this just poetry or another guise for Mara? It's exactly right. It is another guise for Mara. Mara is often called the end maker in the suttas. And now that you mention it, antakaro is the Pali word. Why is Mara called the end maker? It's a good question. And I'm not sure if I know exactly why, but I suppose that Mara is the end maker in the sense that Mara leads to death, Mara leads to the ending of the practice of the Buddhist path, and in this sense it leads to end. It's the wrong kind of end. It doesn't lead to the end of samsara, it leads to the kind of ends which are the suffering in life. And that is why Mara is called an end maker, probably. But I'm not sure, I must admit, I'm not 100% sure exactly why. I can try to find out. And I'll let you know if I found out why Mara is called the end maker. Okay, maybe one last question, sir. Could you say something about using the perception of beauty and happiness to keep the mind contented and balanced in the present? Okay, so yeah, this is a very important part of the path of samadhi, is to have a happy state of mind, to see something beautiful when you practice. This is very important. If you don't have that, then as it says here, you will not tend not to be contented. It is the beauty that, as Ajahn Brahm would say, provides the glue in meditation, that glues you on to the meditation object. So, for example, there are many many ways of dealing with this, but one way is to see the beauty of the breath. If you ever get to the breath meditation, that comes usually beyond the things that I've been teaching here. First of all, you have to make your mind peaceful, and then when your mind is peaceful, you can start watching the breath, or you can do metta meditation, all these other things. But then when your minds become peaceful, you have to look for the beauty and the happiness in that breath. And there are many things you can do. You can see the breath, as Ajahn Brahm likes to say, you see the breath as this old friend who's always been there for you, always supported you. Without the breath, you basically wouldn't be here. The breath is fundamental to our life. So you can sort of anthropomorphize the breath, like make it into a being, something which supports you, something which is helpful in your practice. And then when you see the breath as something beautiful, that is when it becomes more powerful, it becomes very attractive, and your focus on the breath becomes very easy, because it's like your attention is glued onto things that are beautiful. And this also happens by itself. If you keep on watching the breath and you are going in the right direction, the mind becomes peaceful, the joy and happiness will tend to arise by itself if you keep doing this for long enough. And so when that happiness arises, again, it provides the glue. It becomes this thing that Ajahn Brahm calls the beautiful breath. The breath together with joy and happiness, you are glued onto it. But one of the ways and one of the reasons that I like to focus on metta practice is because metta practice helps us overcome the negative tendencies of the mind, these things, and it can lift the mind up into a very beautiful state. So if you are able to make the metta practice work, you're able to lift the mind up, to make the mind more beautiful, then after that metta, after you've taken that to a certain level, then you can go back to the breath, and then try to watch the breath, because then you may find that you have a power that you didn't have before. So you need to experiment a little bit like this, to try to find a way whereby the breath meditation becomes beautiful and pleasant, using metta, using your perception to see the breath as an old friend, etc., etc. This is how you have to play around a little bit. But don't underestimate the power of metta. I know that there are many people who sort of plug away at the breath year after year, sometimes not really getting anywhere, not having much success. And it is important to always remember that the Buddhist path is a path of investigation. If you're not getting anywhere, there is a reason why you're not getting anywhere. So investigate. Look. Maybe your mind isn't pure enough. Try something else. Move on to metta. Purify your thinking mind so that you have more sense of kindness and compassion in your life. And then, with that improved purity, then go back to the breath again. Remember to investigate. Don't become like a Buddhist automaton that just walks around and does the right thing without thinking about it. Reflect, investigate, and then help that to propel your path forward. And then hopefully you will make much more progress because you are being wise about what you're doing. Okay, I think that is probably enough.